Okay, you gotta put the headphones on.
So oh, you can hear. If I didn't love you so much, there's no way in hell I'd do this.
So I'm glad I recorded that.
Welcome to Web Friends. I'm Garth Braithwaite. The show's been away for a little bit, but it's back with a special episode.
This is a great story. This is one of those marvelous stories.
Before we get to the guest, we're going to get an introduction from one of my favorite people.
Annie Braithwaite.
Annie is pretty amazing.
I work in a doctor's office. I'm one of three receptionists.
She also happens to be my mom, and she's here to introduce our guest, who happens to be my dad. And they've known each other since they were little.
I am actually one of four children. I'm the youngest. And as an infant, the four of us were abandoned in South Africa. And so we ended up in an orphanage, the Johannesburg Children's Home. And the others, so there was a boy, a girl, and me. And the boy was put into a separate orphanage, and the girls were adopted away. So all of my growing up time, all of my growing up years, I never knew those two girls at all. I knew what their names were, and I always knew I had two sisters. The interesting thing was that my brother was never allowed to be legally adopted. My father wouldn't allow it. So he was a foster child, really, his whole life. And I was taken in by a single woman who was older. When I look at pictures of her now, when I was little, she looks like she's like 60 years old. Not kidding. Bun, glasses, kind of round, kind of like Aunt Bee. That's what she looked like.
Okay.
I didn't even realize that that was strange, but if I look at pictures, she looks like Aunt Bee. Anyway, Aunt Bee had a brother whose name was Hartley, and he lived in Durban with his family, and we lived in Johannesburg, and we would save our money all year long to go down to Durban to go on holiday. And Hartley was living in Durban, so we always stopped by to visit him. And he had three children, a son, a daughter, and a wretched youngest son, who was definitely not my favorite person.
Quick spoiler, that would be my dad.
That was David, my David, who I fell madly in love with.
They did not fall in love at that time, though.
No, not for many years. Not until I was 17 years old.
So my dad was not always very nice to my mom.
Yeah, so here's the classic. I remember going into the kitchen in Durban one morning and David saying to me, "I bet you can't drink this water." And it was this huge glass. I was little and I tried and tried and tried and tried to drink it. And I think it actually was pouring out of my nose at one point. And I was trying really hard and he laughed at me. And I was raised as an only child. And here was this older person who was then mocking me. Oh, I hated him.
Thankfully, he grew up a bit. And my mom's description of him now is very different.
He's a good man. I guess that I don't know how to pay a higher compliment to a man than to say that he's a good man. And something that I can tell you a thousand things I love about him, but one of the things I love is that he loves animals and birds and anything that is a creature. And I don't think he'd hurt a fly. Well, he would. We do have a fly swatter, so he would smash flies. But if you go on a road trip with him, he sees all the animals and all the birds and all the things that nobody else sees, because that's what he does. He looks and finds those things.
My dad also makes an excellent friend.
Well, let's talk about his friend, Sorrel.
Okay.
Sorrel is his childhood friend from South Africa. And when they get together, it's hilarious because Sorrel thinks of all the things that they knew and did as children, and then they laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. And when your dad laughs, everybody's got to laugh because you can't help yourself. He doesn't forget friends. He may not see people for years and years and years, but he's aware of people who have touched his life. And I think he recognizes the impact people have made on him. And so there's always respect and deference given out of gratitude for what people have done because they've been a part of his life. And when he learns a lesson from a friend, and just listening to him talk to you before, when he learns a lesson, he repeats it over and over and over if it's a good one, and he teaches the lesson to other people. That's a great friend.
So in a second, you're about to hear some of these great lessons from my dad that he's learned and things that he's shared with me over the years. But before that, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsor.
This episode of Web Friends is sponsored by Campaign Monitor. Sending email campaigns doesn't need to be a chore. Campaign Monitor makes it fun, easy, and beautiful. Try your hand at their template builder and have a responsive email template ready in 60 seconds. Campaign Monitor also lets you offer their services to your clients at your prices. And if you need help creating better emails, Campaign Monitor just released a free ebook with their top 100 email campaigns of 2013.
So I wanted to give a little bit of context before we start listening to the interview. My dad is a programmer, and as you'll hear, he's a self-taught user experience designer as well. But on top of that, my dad is an active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church. And in the last couple of decades, he has served as a bishop of two different wards, which are geographical units of the church. And I mention this because he starts the interview sharing some of the types of things that he would share with couples when he counseled with them. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and listen to the interview.
I don't know. Do I call you David? That doesn't seem right. So Papa, what's the best advice that you've received in your life, personal or professional, something that's kind of stuck with you?
Well, one of the things that I wished I had learned earlier was a lesson I'd learned from reading a book called The Road Less Traveled by Dr. Scott Peck. And in that book, he just talks about love. And he said, love's kind of a hard thing to define. But always, there are a couple of components that are always there if it's true love. One is it takes work. And the other is it's always for the spiritual betterment of the other party. And then he says, let's compare that with falling in love. He says falling in love takes no work at all. And it's also very selfish. It's really self-serving. It doesn't have anything to do with what's the best thing for the other person. It's selfish. And then he said also in this book about the difference between love and falling in love is that falling in love is temporary. He calls it temporary insanity. And by the very nature, it has to end. But what it is, falling in love, you lower your boundaries. You let someone in much closer than you'd normally let somebody in. And you make promises that in your right frame of mind you never make. You promise someone you'll love them for the rest of your life, for better or worse. No matter what happens, you promise them that. And then, because it's temporary, eventually it goes away. And once it's gone, a person's integrity kicks in and you have to decide whether you're going to keep those promises you made while you were insane. Hmm. So then you start the real work of love. And it is work. It's a verb, not a noun or an adjective. And you have to work at loving somebody. And then it replaces falling in love with something that's so much more significant and real and fulfilling. But some people never learn the difference. And when the falling in love goes away, they think they've made a mistake. And often they go around looking for another in love episode. And I think each time they do that, they replace it with something less wonderful and less wonderful. It reminds me of the scripture in the Old Testament that says, keep thine heart with all diligence, for out of it come the issues of life. And I think each time you give your love to somebody, giving a piece of your heart away until eventually you've got nothing left. You find the right person and it's gone, you know?
So if real love is work, what does that work look like?
I love the Fiddler on the Roof analogy where Tevye's got this thing going on with his daughters all wanting to marry for love. So then finally looks at his wife and he says, Golda says, do you love me? And she says, do I what? And he says, do you love me? And she says, after 35 years of cooking your food, washing your clothes and giving your children, if that's not love, what is? So he says, then you love me. And she says, I suppose I do. And he says, and I suppose I love you too. That's that wonderful song that comes from that. And I love that because that's love. Falling in love's got nothing to compare with that.
I remember a story that you've told me before about a husband that would go out and start up and warm up his wife's car in the cold Montana winters and get it ready for her. You don't remember the story? If I can remember it correctly, and see if I can jog your memory. If I remember it correctly, they were having a hard time. And so their marriage, I assume they were married, they were having a hard time. And so I think you talked with them and you challenged them to find ways to serve each other. And I want to say that he, even though they weren't communicating very well at that point, every morning he would go out and he would scrape her windshield and he would start her car and he would have some warm beverage waiting for her in the car. And that ultimately that kind of helped spark the communication back again. You don't remember the story?
Well, I remember the concept.
Okay.
I think those are wonderful cures for struggles in marriage. Looking every day to see, what can I do? So I would counsel the couples to go and look for something you can do for the other person and go and look and see what the other person's done for you. So it's not just doing, it's also recognizing what other people do for you. And this wife of mine's the most amazing person at looking to see and then expressing appreciation. She's always expressing appreciation. Even years after I've done something, she'd go and say, thank you so much for this again and again.
See, and I remember growing up when there was a few times where mom wasn't at home, where she was traveling and we were home with you. That wasn't very common. But when it did happen that you would do some project, you wanted to impress, surprise her when she got back. Sometimes it was just waxing the floor or scrubbing the floor to the point where it's never been that clean ever before. And we did a pretty good job of keeping the rest of the house clean and being fed and all those things. But on top of that, you always tried to use the opportunity when mom was gone to do some great thing for her.
So I had a good example for that with my father. I remember my mother and sister going to Kenya for 3 months after her mother and father were badly injured. And when she came home, he had recovered our furniture. And I mean, this is a masculine man. Reupholstered it. And he'd taken this thing apart and cut fabric to match the old fabric and figured out how it worked and put it all back together. So when she came home, she had basically new furniture without us having had the money to do that. So that was a nice thing.
She noticed and she was impressed.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So what else? Is there any other advice that has kind of stuck with you? Have you had any mentors or great examples?
Terry Jensen was an amazing mentor.
Yeah?
Gave me lots and lots of great advice. He told me I was doing too much for Annie and I needed to let her take care of some of the things like finances. I needed to give her a chance with the finances. When we moved to Pennsylvania, I turned it over to her. And I wished I'd done it years before because for the first time in our marriage, she saw where the money was going and had a much more realistic attitude toward what we could do and what we couldn't. It was great. And it also made her more independent so that if something happened to me, she'd be able to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And so years ago in South Africa, somebody named Evan P. Wright, he was a turned mission president, came back to South Africa and introduced D. Burgess to South Africa, and that put on a fireside that always stuck with me. The topic was, prepare your wife to be a widow.
Hmm.
I thought it was very clever.
It's a little bit
macabre.
Morose of a topic. But it's those things that the conversations and the things that you don't think about that will happen or have a potential of happening that if we pretend like they're not going to, it actually damages us or hurts us in the end. Okay. So
so that extends to lots of things. When I married Annie, she couldn't drive. And I worked with a man in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. His wife never learned to drive. And he paid a huge price for that. When I married her, she said she didn't want to drive. But I can't imagine her having been the mother of five children and not driving. Yeah. And me being out of town and that. So over the years, I've watched her become more and more independent and more capable of doing without me. And I'm thrilled at all of that.
So that's an interesting point. They're part of your job. I remember growing up, we lived, for most of my life, my early life, we lived in Seattle. We lived in Bellevue, outside of Seattle. And you had a lot of your clients. You had your own business doing, creating software and maintaining software and hardware, or just the software?
Some hardware.
Some hardware. And you, most of your clients were up in Calgary, Alberta.
Well, when you were young, my biggest one was in Philadelphia.
Veco. Okay. And we lived out in Pennsylvania for a couple months, for a summer.
6 months.
6 months.
We went there in June, July, and we stayed till Christmas, just before Christmas.
Okay. I turned four. That's all I remember, was being at the beach and mom making cupcakes and giving them to strangers, and that was my birthday party.
And I remember the thing most about that age for you was the song Dreidel, Dreidel, Dreidel.
Yeah, so I went to a Jewish preschool, or man, it must have been a preschool, and so we made latkes and made dreidels, and yeah. So you were on the road a bit. What did you do to stay in contact with your family? I mean, we didn't have email. We didn't have the internet.
Telephone calls were so expensive.
Canadian.
We had times when our phone bill was $700, $800 a month. And that was a lot of money in those days. So we had a deal for a long time where I would call her once a week. Typically, I think it was on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, something like that. And we'd time how long we could speak for. And that had to take care of the whole week's communication. And Anne was a master at making the kids feel that I was present all week long. I remember saying one day to Cameron, after he was grown, did you feel bad that I was gone so much of the time? And he questioned me on what I meant by being gone so much of the time. And that was Anne's doing.
Yeah.
Made kids feel like I was home when I wasn't.
I'd have to echo that as well. I don't remember you being gone. At least I don't remember long periods of time. I just remember the phone calls. And so that's the only way I can remember that you were gone and traveling.
And it was interesting. I learned a lesson from Cameron because one day I left on a business trip without telling him I was going.
Mm.
And that night I called from Philadelphia. And when he found out I was in Philadelphia, he was so mad at me that I hadn't told him. Because you could handle it if you knew about it. But the surprise was really upsetting. So that was a good lesson for me.
And as we got older, you would actually take us with you on some of the business trips.
It was a lot of fun for me.
So we had the convenience that most of your trips, especially when you were going to Alberta and British Columbia, you drove. As opposed to the Philadelphia ones, I don't think you could have taken us with you if you were flying with the airfares. But why would you go through that work? Because I look back at it now as a parent, and I'm trying to imagine going to a conference or going to visit my office and taking my kids. I'd have to think that it would somewhat limit productivity.
The worst was when I took Morgan. That did limit productivity. In fact, the trip I took Morgan, I had to cut short and come home, bring him home because I wasn't getting much done. Hmm.
So why would you go through the effort? Did you see the benefit? Was there a noticeable benefit to that?
I had a missionary companion named Jim Sonnenberg, and he was one of 8 or 10 kids or something. And he told me how his father would take each kid out individually on one-on-one dates with him, so that even though he was one of many children, he still felt like he had a one-on-one relationship with his father. And that really impressed me. That was where that came from.
Okay. Yeah, and I can see times when you did that. I remember you coming on scout campouts, and that was very much one-on-one, especially with me. I didn't have any close brothers in age.
You weren't there when I was being the scoutmaster, though. You were too young for that. I went to the bishop and I said, this war doesn't have a scout program. Andrew was 12 and Cameron was 11. I said, if you don't get a scout program going, I'm putting them into a non-LDS scout troop. I think the next week I was called to be scoutmaster. And I remember going to the week-long scout camp, getting the kids off on all the activities and spending the next 3 hours on a payphone with customers. And after lunch, the same thing. Hmm. So it was hard.
Okay, so there's a little bit of advice that I know you've given me. That I'd like to hear maybe a little bit of the backstory. There's some advice that you said, be careful when you're at work. Be careful about what you tell them you're capable of doing. Don't tell them you can do something that you don't actually want to do. I think it was something around IT support. There was a computer that had a problem, and you were a little bit worried about just going through and taking care of the problem yourself.
There was a gentleman I'd worked with that, when I asked him how he'd been so successful in his career, he said he had to dumb down the IT capability he had. One day he was at a presentation, they were struggling to get the projector going and hooking up with the computer and that. And he just had to sit there and not let on that he knew how to do that. Because when you're an IT person, that becomes so vital that it doesn't matter what your career goals or aspirations are, that need needs to be met regardless of your personal needs. And so in that position, you don't become the president of a company or a vice president or some of these other positions because you're needed at the down at the battle line. And I really believe that. I remember when I was selling computers for ADP, each sale was so important to them that it didn't matter what my personal needs were, what my personal life was like. This brought in $100,000, and so that became the overriding concern, much more important than me as a person. So it's the same kind of thing.
So then how did you come to balance it? So in the case of ADP, eventually you broke off from ADP and became somewhat of a competitor to them. Is that just because it...
I looked at all the software around for auto dealers, and I thought ADP had the best and was horrible. So I thought, I'll spend a couple of years writing better software, and then I'll go out and sell it. Didn't realize I'd spend the next 20 years writing software. That wasn't my goal.
No, but you had sold it while you were writing it.
Well, I never did spec programming. I always had a customer say, we'll hire you to do this for us. My first one was I was in Calgary, Alberta, and I found out that this one dealership that I was doing some work for had a sister company, which was a truck leasing rental company. And I went up there, and I was planning on flying out that night, and I changed my flight plan, and I spent the night writing up a proposal. And I went down into Calgary, and I got it typed for me. And then I had copies made up, and I went and delivered this proposal to this company before I flew out of town. And 2 weeks later, they signed a contract with me to provide them with a general ledger, receivables, payables, lease management, rental management, and I'd never written one line of code for any of that. And I was panicking when I went home.
So how did you meet the contract then?
So I bought a computer, built a computer room in my garage with an air conditioner and a 220-volt power supply. Got the computer running, and I thought I'd get a lot of program done, but I got so little done at home. Then I had to package it up and crate it and ship it up to Calgary. And then I just went there, and I found that I could get so much more work done working on site. So that's became my modus operandi. That's how it worked.
Okay.
So I delivered the computer, and 6 weeks after delivering the computer, I'd converted all the data from an IBM service bureau that they had in Canada. 6 weeks after getting it converted, I printed up their first accounts receivable statements live. And so that was amazing to go from nothing to full bore accounts receivable piggybacking on the general ledger. Was all integrated.
So then how did you work out maintenance after that? This is your first piece of software that you've written in a commercial setting like this for your new business.
It was such a high for me. I think I was living on adrenaline. I used to go and work. I remember one day working 48 hours, sleeping 8, coming back and working 36.
That's not a day.
and I just had such a flow of ideas. The creativity was just the most incredible thing I'd experienced. It was a high, it really was. And when I finished and got most of it running, then I had lots of little codes to do to make it, you know, where I was perfect. So I spent 2 years on that project. And one day when I finished, they invited me up to this little conference room upstairs. They had the whole staff. And when I went in, they gave me a standing ovation.
Wow.
Thanking me for the software I'd given them.
So were they paying you hourly while you were working on it?
Maintenance after the project was hourly.
Okay. But initially it was a fixed bid.
Yeah, I quoted them fixed bid.
And it lasted, the bid that you quoted was estimated correctly, that lasted you 2 years?
Oh, I'm sure I was going to get it done a lot sooner than that. So I did a lot of that, quite high prices, and then eat it in the long run.
Yeah.
I remember selling a system to Iveco Trucks, and we had friends of ours, Steve Oliver, staying with us. And I got the phone call that they signed the deal. It was a $200,000 deal for the hardware and software. And he said to me, "Why aren't you excited?" I said, "Because I know how much work I've just committed to." And so I used to leave on a Sunday night, fly overnight, and work all week. For a long time, it was 6 weeks, and then come home for a week or two. But near the end, it was just working for a week at a time. I bought a bicycle, kept it in a motel, and I lived really frugally.
Hmm. Yeah, because you already had a mortgage at home and all the expenses there. And was that also where you played Miss Pac-Man? Was that at Iveco?
It was at Calgary. They had the truck leasing agency. One of their customers was a video game rental company, and they went and put a Miss Pac-Man in their kitchen. And we used to play free Miss Pac-Man. So the one guy that I worked with, when he went home at night, his wife would put a hand on the back of his neck, and if it had been sweaty, she'd say, "I know you've been playing Miss Pac-Man." And they developed calluses on their fingers. They played so much. It was fun.
That was the only video game that you really played. That and Tetris.
Well, Tetris was my kids that got me into that. Yeah. Now, I remember the kids getting me into Mario as well.
That's true. Okay. So let's go back over some of the advice we've talked about. You started with talking about the difference between falling in love and being in love.
Falling in love and loving.
And loving. And you talked about the difference. Let's see. You talked about serving, and that was part of the love. And you talked about not only serving, but recognizing when others have done things for you, particularly in the case of a spouse. You talked about, let's see, what else did we mention? We did a little bit talking about don't volunteer to do something that you don't want to keep doing in the case of IT work. And the importance of, even when you're traveling, of involving your family. In the case of us having 5 kids in our family, of trying to spend one-on-one time with them as well. Okay. Okay, so then the second question is what's something that you've learned the hard way? If you could go back and give yourself advice, or in this case, if you could give advice to new developers or anybody, young people in general, what advice would you give? Or what's advice that you wish you had received?
I think some of my big early mistakes were not communicating enough with the customer, knowing where I was and what I was doing, not taking the time to keep them abreast of what I was doing and where I was at. I lost 2 customers in Kelowna, British Columbia, because I was doing great work and they didn't know. And ADP came in and undermined me significantly because I hadn't kept them up to date with where I was. Mm. It was a mistake for me.
Now, that's interesting because you think about those moments where you are on that adrenaline high. And they call that, some people call that flow, being in a state of flow at that point where the code just flows out of you. It seems like progress reports would rip you right out of that state. So there's got to be a balance, right? There's got to be a time to ignore the communication with the client so that you can actually do things. And then the time that you have to update them.
When I was working with Iveco, that was especially obvious. I felt that if they looked at what I was doing, they'd see I was accomplishing so much. I was putting in 12, 15 hours a day, and I was getting so much done for what were my customers. They were extensions of the company I worked for. But what was all important to my boss's boss was the pie chart and the graph that I would give her, showing her where I was at. So much more important than what I was actually doing. And I could see how she would rate some people as being very effective based on how successful the appearance of their reports were, so much more than the substance of what they were doing. And I found that very difficult.
It's like you need a little monkey who's just watching and he writes his own status reports.
When I was given the position, I asked if I could have a secretary, and I said, you'll get twice as much work out of me if you'll give me one, because I could have delegated all that kind of work.
Yeah. Now, it would have to be a pretty technical secretary, though, to be able to understand what you're doing. That's interesting. Almost you need a junior developer or intern. Okay. Anything else? Is there anything else that you've had to learn the hard way?
Well, I don't know. It's almost like I knew it from the beginning. I learned very early on that in software, when you're writing applications, you need to cater to the capability of when a user realizes they've made a mistake. Don't require them to wait till the end to go back and fix it. A lot of the software I saw other people write did that, and it's horrible because people forget, and so it makes their work more shoddy. You give them the capability to make it really easy to go back and fix the mistake immediately and then return to where they were. You make their work so much better. And it's a great way to write software.
See, in talking to you and the way that you've developed, I remember you getting excited about your user interface. And I think you were a bit progressive in that respect, because I don't think a lot of the software competitors at that time were concerned very much with user experience, is what we call it today. User experience design, making sure that the user has the easiest time of getting their task done, the most enjoyable as you can make it. What was the driving factor for you there? Because you could have just done what was easiest for you as a developer, but I remember you taking pride in going the extra mile. You said, I did this cool thing. Look how much faster it is now.
Well, when I developed software, I told you I always developed on site, so I could see how the users interacted. My competitor or my contrast was pretty much ADP, and they would do scroll-up data entry. So you're always looking at the last line and just scrolling up. And someone came and said the reason they prefer that is because if you did screen-formatted inputting, you always had to struggle when you look up, because a lot of the data entry, they weren't looking at screen, and then something went wrong and you have to look up and find out where you were on the screen. So I decided I loved formatted screen data entry, so you could see the whole thing at once and it all made sense. But I made sure that you always knew where you were on the screen. And I had a second last line and last line. The second last line was always where you went to look and see the communication. So I had data belonging in specific places on the screen, and the second last line on the screen was always where you looked to see where you were at, and it would tell you the field number. So I had everything identified.
Okay.
And then the
last... So it would give you a cursor position.
It would say you're in column, and it would show you where on the screen. And then I always had that box, reverse video, so you could look in the screen and know where you were. And also, I always had the last line be the error reporting line. So if it was trying to tell you something, never had to look over the screen, but it made it nice to work with. So it was always this fine line of data entry where people don't look at the screen, you know, just key entry. And beginners working with totally looking at the screen, and you need to include both capabilities. So that was my focus.
And you had single color terminals. So you couldn't do something like here's an error in red. Or
later on I got some of those capabilities.
Okay. So otherwise you had to do things like the reverse video
right.
to highlight something or
I hated the blinking, but they also had that capability.
Okay.
And sounding the bell. It got your attention.
Yeah, but it seems like there's the right time to use some of those things. Otherwise, they just become a nuisance. I find sometimes there's certain applications, even still on the Mac, when I hit escape because I'm trying to get out of something and I'm in the wrong application, it just yells at me. It just becomes bothersome.
And then so we had to decide. I had to make my own standards. What did I want the tab key to do? What did I want the enter key to do? What did I want the escape key to do? What did I want the arrow keys to do? And so I built my own standard, and then I wrote so much software that complete every aspect of my applications all followed exactly that standard because it was the same author. And it eliminated a lot of the... I mean, the joke was one of the companies I worked with, they used to complain so often, the users complained so often because they could never tell in one particular routine what the standard was going to be, because based on who wrote it, would have a different standard.
So you had consistent user experience design across a suite of applications that you made. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't think we're in an age right now where you could have a single developer create a suite of applications. So it's pretty unique.
And for a while, Von Kraft was working with me, and we made an appointment to go and show my software to ADP.
Yeah.
And we went down and they were very impressed with the presentation we made. And then they came and asked me how many developers I'd had work to develop that. And when I told them it was just me, I lost all credibility with them. They stopped talking to me.
They didn't believe you?
Didn't believe it was possible. It's contrasted to what they had done. You know, they liked the software and then they just didn't think that was feasible.
Do you think there was a point, was part of your goal to be acquired by ADP? Would that have been a nice exit strategy for you, for your business?
Sure.
Okay. Not that you were relying on it, though. There are a lot of startups, tech startups, that's still their end goal.
I had some investors promise me $1 million to invest and get the business going. So I went up to Kelowna, British Columbia, and I'd sold one dealership a system. Because of them committing $1 million and the extra help, I went and signed up a second dealership and was working them simultaneously. And then their funding and their help never came through. And that's where I lost the deal I was telling you about. And
yeah. It wasn't a lack of work there. It was a lack of resources.
I couldn't do both at the same time.
Okay.
Came close. I had to go and remember wiring a tape drive on an ADP computer to connect to a competing device so I could pull data off ADP's computer and put it on mine. Pretty amazing stuff. I wasn't sure I could even pull it off.
So you were integrating your system with theirs?
I had to pull data off their system.
Okay.
I actually had to make a tape drive on their computer feed talk to a computer of mine. Which
you didn't have exactly, you didn't have their API, you didn't know how to communicate with their system or what format their data was going to come out in or anything like that. You had to parse through it. And if they updated the system, you would have been in trouble.
See, my very first thing that got me out on my own was I was up in Calgary, Alberta, and we were selling a system to Shaw GMC Trucks. They were the largest truck dealer in Western Canada, and they were with an IBM service bureau. In the States, IBM got legislation required them to divest themselves of the service arm of their company. In Canada, that wasn't the case. So anyway, they were in an IBM service bureau, and they were able to take their parts, reorder. The system would recommend reordering of parts, and then would put together what was called a stock order. And then IBM was able to transmit that to General Motors. ADP had no capability to do an automatic feed to General Motors. So when we were trying to get them to buy an ADP system, they said, if we have to manually sit at a telex machine and type up our whole order, we won't buy your system. So I said, I wrote a personal addendum to the contract that I, David Braithwaite, would personally guarantee an automated interface for their parts stock order to General Motors in Canada. And my company had it as grounds for termination to do personal software.
Yeah.
But they wanted the contract so much that they approved it, but just pretended my addendum didn't exist. So they didn't give me formal permission to do it. So they really left me out to take care of it myself. So in Canada, they didn't have the telex machines that they had in the States, which were an 8-bit code. They had a Twix machine in Canada, which was a 5-bit code. So what happened is, because it was only 5 bits to a character, you had to have a preceding character saying, I'm shifting to uppercase or lowercase, I'm shifting to numeric or alpha. And so what I did is I took and I went and bought a paper tape punch that punched 8 bits, which was the normal US thing.
Right.
And I wrote a conversion for every character that converted to this 5-bit code and also remembered whether it was alpha or numeric or upper or lowercase and would do the switching. So then I put it in as a device on the computer, and they, like they were printing their stock order report, which my software just converted all and make it work on this Twix machine. Oh. So we automated. And so I sold quite a few of those in Canada. That's when I left ADP to go and start putting these paper tape punches in all over Toronto and all over the place.
So you put the customer first and you took care of their needs. It's interesting how you made that transition from sales into developing software.
I sold a computer in Hawaii. They asked me please to take Hawaii on as a territory, and ADP had been infamous at saying they were going to go into a territory and then changing their minds. And I said I didn't want to go invest in there because it was such a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sure that they wouldn't support me in there. So they gave me some assurances. And I went and sold a computer on the big island of Hilo in the big island of Hawaii. And then the contract sat on the desk of the general manager, of the vice president, for months, 3 months. And only when they heard that this company had hired a technical person and that technical person was at the training class, did they approve the contract. So then they shipped the computer to the customer in Hilo, and they never committed the resources to go and install the computer. So I took a week's vacation and flew to Hilo, and I was sales. I wasn't support. And I installed the computer for them, and they were so grateful. They sent a big can of macadamia nuts home with me to take to my wife to say thank you. And they also picked up my airfare, my costs of airfare. So, and then, you might need to edit this out.
So I did edit it out. So my dad shares a really excellent story about a time that he helped out a specific client who needed access to the source code to be able to make some changes. So I'm not going to go into the full details because that was the whole point of editing it out. But I have to say that it does feel a little Richard Stallman-esque. And it makes me very proud of my dad doing open source-ish type of work before it was even really a thing. So one more question, kind of changing tracks here. You taught us as kids the importance of work ethic. And you somehow inspired in me a desire to be involved in technical things. And now I have 5 kids of my own. And some of them are young women or soon to be young women. And our industry right now is kind of notorious for, it's either the education system or our country's culture, but of squashing this skill of engineering in young women.
But some of the best programmers I've worked with have been women.
Okay, so this is the question. Is there anything that you could recommend to me as a young parent, younger parent? I mean, I've got 5 kids. I'm not that young. But that I could do to help inspire them to be involved in these things. And I remember you telling me once that if I learned how to program, I would always have a job in college, even if I didn't want to program as my profession for the rest of my life, but that I would always be able to find work.
You know where that came from?
Mm.
I'd hired Vaughn to come and work for me, Vaughn Croft, and he came and worked with me for about a year. He hadn't finished his degree at BYU yet, and he learned PEC programming and became proficient at it. So when he went back to BYU to finish his degree, he was able to get superior employment, earn more than the minimum wage, and do a good job of supporting his family. So I learned firsthand through him that okay. That was a good strategy.
So then how do you inspire that in kids?
So what got you going?
I don't know. I think I realized, one, you always had the resources available. You had computers, and we had access to them. You never restricted access to technology for us. Even though, looking back on it now, you probably used those machines for your work. We always had a time when you weren't working, we were allowed to go down to your office. And I remember Andrew started it. But we would use CorelDRAW to make... We started with making cases for mixtapes. And that's where I got started with... That's my first foray, I guess, into computer-assisted design or computer-based design. But you never... I don't remember you ever sitting us down and showing us how to use computers.
I think I just bought the product. So you had the paper to print on and you had the templates and stuff. But I used to laugh when you would spend time on chat groups and I'd say to you, why don't you pick up the phone and talk to your friends? And you'd say to me, Dad... I don't remember which one it was. Tom is so much funnier in a chat room than when you talk to him on the phone.
I'm funnier. I think I'm much funnier via text or chat than I am in person sometimes even. And there's something about being able to think through what I'm saying. And you see that in the youth now. I mean, I was texting before it was actually texting. I was chatting. Okay. So, yeah, I guess that is a good point. You always made the technology available. And even when it was something that wasn't related to your work, you didn't ever use CorelDRAW that I can remember for anything.
I did some stuff.
Did you?
Mm.
But you always I don't know. It seemed like you would go out of your way to find out what interested us in that area and help us out. I remember you purchasing clip art. I think we also had print shop. We used that. We remember making...
A lot of that was for your mother, too.
Okay. I remember making posters for you when you did come home on the old dot matrix printer with the long sheets. It was so much better for making banners than anything we have now because they're all connected, and we'd pull off the little edge with the holes in it and string that up.
So just expose your girls to as much technology as you can.
Okay. They've got a pretty good start.
Don't do it for them. I watched your little 2-year-old using the iPhone to call you today. I was absolutely blown away that she was able to call you.
She didn't have anything to say once she got a hold of me. but yeah, she enjoys calling me. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dad.
That's welcome.
For letting me come and chat with you. It's interesting to go back and talk through these things. Okay, so I'm going to stop the recording there. So usually at the end of episodes, I kind of take a moment to share a little extra advice. But I really don't have much else to add. I will say, this break with web friends that I had for a few months, I would recommend always coming back to the things that are important to you. It's best if you don't leave them in the first place, to be honest. It's much easier to keep up a routine if you're doing something regularly. But just because you stop doing it for a while doesn't mean that it's gone forever. Go ahead and try and jump back into those projects that you absolutely love, and you'll find that you'll be inspired again by them.
I want to thank Campaign Monitor for supporting Web Friends. And of course, above all, I want to thank you for listening to the show. You are awesome.